Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as a tour of the battle space of the war for the free world. Few people have helped illuminate the complexities, the challenges, the dangers of that war for the free world than our first guest. He will be with us, I'm very pleased to say, for two segments. He is Joel Rosenberg, a mega New York Times best-selling author for works like The Last Jihad, The Last Days, The Ezekiel Option, on and on. We're going to talk first in the initial segment with Joel about a brand new book that he has just released entitled Implosion. Can America recover from its economic and spiritual challenges in time? And Joel, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's always a pleasure to have a chance to talk with you, and I'm only sorry that it seems to be on the occasion of you cranking out yet another book, because I'm a few behind, to be honest with you. But congratulations on the new one. Tell us a little bit about Implosion, the thesis of the piece, and what you really want people to take away from it.
Well, I appreciate it, Frank. It's an honor to be back with you. Look, as you know, when you and I talk about the books I've done in the past, they're primarily about the threat of radical Islam and how we as Americans, as well as our allies all over the world, but notably in the Middle East, notably Israel, that we're threatened in all kinds of ways. What's interesting is that I was continuing to do research over the years about radical Islam and their intentions for us. One of the themes that became crystal clear in that research, for one of my books, Inside the Revolution, for example, is how Islamic leaders, radical Islamic leaders, are absolutely convinced that the United States is going to collapse and implode, and they believe it's their job to help accelerate that, whether through economic jihad, what they explicitly call for, or, of course, obviously, terrorist attack, nuclear war, chemical weapons, whatever they can get their hands on. What's striking to me in all the language of all those radical Islamic leaders talking about the destruction of America because they believe they helped accelerate the implosion of the Soviet Union in Afghanistan in that battle is how many Americans are coming to the fear that America could implode, could collapse, not because of the same analysis of the radical Islamic jihadists, but for a different set, but actually there is some overlap. Americans are increasingly looking at our economic situation, our massive and rising debt, $15.6 trillion and soaring, up an extra trillion to $1.2 trillion every year now under the Obama administration, and they're saying that's unsustainable. You know, it's like we're on the Titanic. We can see the iceberg of debt ahead of us, yet rather than slow down or turn or stop, we've accelerated from the $300 to $400 billion
full speed ahead
in the last years of the Bush administration, which were outrageous and horrible. And I say that as a conservative who supported generally the president's war on radical Islam. But he went crazy on spending, and now it's five times worse. So that's where we are economically.
Yeah, and let's just tie this in, as you do in Implosion, Joel Rosenberg, to the spiritual piece of this, the demoralization, I guess, the hollowing out, really, of our confidence in our institutions and leadership. And how does that fit into this story of economic decline that is at hand?
Well, the economic decline, is such an urgent issue, but in some ways for people, even though they sense that's coming, if we don't turn things around, it's still a little bit esoteric. on the moral, spiritual, cultural side, it's much more personal for people. People are watching families implode. Divorce, adultery, child abuse, teen drug use, teen suicide. I mean, when we start talking language like that, people all identify with that we are watching things implode around us, and sometimes in our own personal lives. Let me just give you an example. The FBI just recently put out new crime statistics for the country. Now, the good news was crime overall was down slightly. But in small-town America, towns of 10,000 people or less, there's been this huge crime wave. Murders are skyrocketing. Murders in small-town America up 18.3% last year alone. Now, you're thinking, this is Andy Griffith, you know, Aunt B, America. You know, okay, in New York, Washington, Chicago, L.A., we sort of got
dens of iniquity.
Trouble.
Yeah.
But not in little towns where you'd say, hey, that's where the values of America are strong, they're healthy, but it's not true. And that's is just a part of the divorce, the violence, the drugs. So we're watching real problems.
Can you put your finger, Joel Rosenberg, on why that has happened? Do you ascribe it to what we've been educating people over these several generations now to think about their country and their personal responsibilities and how, you know, their values should be shaped? Is it this sort of, I think of it, cult of celebrity in our media? Is it the dumbing down of our political leadership? What would you say is responsible for this kind of contribution on the spiritual side to the implosion phenomenon?
Well, Frank, I would say yes, 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 and yes to all those points you just made. In the book Implosion, if I boil all that down, I say, you know, we've turned our hearts and minds away from God. You know, starting in the early 1960s, though actually I believe it started earlier, but we began to see the fruit of feeling, you know, the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, even the greatest generation, they looked at life as, look, we come from a Judeo-Christian society, we've got good morals, we're hardworking people, we won World War II, and we're good to go. But we didn't pass down, they didn't pass down the way they needed to, spiritual, biblical values, and a true, deep faith in Jesus Christ. So what happened is by the 60s, the baby boomers revolted. Not all, clearly, and thank God, but many did. And now we're reaping the next generations of kids that have grown up in a culture that said, we don't want God in the schools, we don't want Bible or prayer in the classrooms or in the public square, or we want strict separation. You can't talk about religious values and biblical principles in legislation. And in the end, when you tell God to, you know, step aside, we want to run our country by ourselves, you know, God is a gentleman, and he doesn't force himself on any person or any country. I believe we're reaping what we've sown. Now, I believe it can be turned around, but I'm not sure that it will be. I think it can be. I'm not sure that it will be. And that is the crux of this implosion book, is if we don't turn back to the Lord and ask him and beg him, really, to have mercy on us and help us get back to those biblical truths, not just generally religious. I'm speaking clearly as a Christian and unashamedly. Our country's in so much trouble. I believe if we don't have what I would call a third great awakening, we are going to morally, spiritually, economically collapse.
Mm. Joel Rosenberg, we've just got a minute before we break, and we're going to come back with more, particularly on sort of your forecast for what happens, particularly in a part of the world that you have been very, very concerned about for a long time and deeply knowledgeable about, namely the Middle East. But I just want to sort of tie in what you've said and sort of make this as a segue. I've been talking a lot lately, Joel, about something President Reagan said long before he became president back, I believe, in August of 1961, when he declared, quote, freedom is never more than one generation away from extinction. We didn't pass it to our children in the bloodstream. It must be fought for, protected, and handed on for them to do the same, or we will one day spend our sunset years telling our children and our children's children what it was once like in the United States where men were free. Unquote. And he, I think, captured poignantly and powerfully a similar kind of admonition to that you were making in this new book, Implosion: Can America Recover from Its Economic and Spiritual Challenges in Time? And we'll talk more with Joel Rosenberg about what we can be doing about it here and elsewhere in the world straight ahead.
I was able to lose the 80 pounds I gained due to pregnancy. It was pretty easy to eat whatever I wanted and not think about it.
The Meta System from Judy Singer has been helping make weight loss easier for a quarter century.
My husband's grandmother used it 20 years ago to lose weight for a wedding and said it was the only way to go.
The Meta System also has an excellent support staff.
They were very supportive. The first time that I ordered the product, they called me and suggested that I order a lower dosage to begin with. They didn't want me to jump the gun right off the bat, and it was nice to know that they actually cared.
And the weight loss is so dramatic, people wonder.
With the Meta System, I've got many questions about how I managed raising a baby and working full-time and lose the weight and eat whatever I wanted.
People who use it recommend it.
I suggested the Meta System to my mother, and she has lost 30 pounds.
Learn more about weight loss with Judy Singer's The Meta System by calling 800-711-JUDY, 800-711-JUDY. The Meta System from Judy Singer, the powerful all-natural way to lose weight, 800-711-JUDY.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit shariathethreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, The Threat to America at amazon.com.
Congress doesn't have a budget for 2011, but the GOP has proposed a budget for 2012, and Bill Bennett likes it.
Maybe it helps to have that 2012 in the background, people hearing and seeing Ryan and the Republicans saying we're serious about really cutting the budget
as a backdrop
to this debate about 2011. People make the decision, well, Republicans seem much more serious about this.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America, weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined once again by Joel Rosenberg, the fabulously successful and I think highly and properly highly regarded author of myriad books on subjects that deal with some of the most existential challenges of our time, including the last jihad and the last days. And now, most recently, a brand new book, Implosion: Can America Recover from Its Economic and Spiritual Challenges in Time? And Joel, before the break, we were talking about what some of those challenges are. And you were just working towards what can be done. You spoke eloquently, as always, about a kind of religious component to this, speaking of your Christian faith and urging others in their own practices to seek God's help in remedying some of the challenges that we're facing, both economic and spiritual. I'd like to spend a minute with you talking about strategic challenges, some of which have been, it seems to me, born of that kind of problem that President Reagan spoke of, 50 years ago, the existential, the generational challenge to freedom. You've addressed in many of your works, and in this one too, I gather, the threat you call radical Islam. I think of it as Sharia, but whatever we call it, it's what is animating a serious challenge to freedom in our time. What's happening at the moment in the Middle East, and how does that track to what you're thinking with kind of, biblical prophecy about the end of times?
Yeah. Well, these are good questions, Frank. I think one of the problems that we're facing is that because the United States is becoming economically weak with so much debt and a stagnant economy, and we're becoming increasingly isolationist because we've got so many problems at home, literally in our homes, and then more generally in the decaying moral and spiritual culture of our country, we don't have the moral and spiritual vitality to tackle some of these problems that we're already engaged in, which is, for example, the battle with radical Islam. People are exhausted, and they don't want to engage. I mean, not everybody, fortunately, but a growing number, even Republicans, are saying, it was good to be done with Iraq. Let's get out of Afghanistan as fast as possible. And what is the effect of that? The effect is right at a moment when radical Islam in Iran is ascendant, and has been building strength against in its radicalism and intensity and belief in the end of days from their own eschatology or end-time theology. Right when that's hitting its peak, we are retreating, literally and figuratively, and we look exhausted, and they see Iranian leaders like Mahmoud Ahmadinejad and the Ayatollah Khamenei, they liken this to the Soviet Union's exhaustion after retreating from Afghanistan. And, of course, the Soviet Union imploded after the Afghan War, and the Iranian leaders believe the United States is going to implode as we pull out of Afghanistan. This is creating blood in the water, as it were, and the sharks are beginning to move. Now, I think Iran is we could neutralize this nuclear threat, but we're not doing it. I'm grateful that the economic sanctions have had more of an effect than, honestly, I had thought that they would. And I think that with the July 1st oil sanctions, we could see a significant tightening around Iran. But now we're apparently, in the last couple of days, now we're giving exemptions to a whole bunch of countries. I don't know how that helps us.
Yeah.
So
you can tell who it helps, though. Certainly helps the Iranians.
Turkey, first and foremost, and it's a big question. Should Turkey even be in NATO at this point?
Excellent.
If they're becoming
question.
So hostile and they won't help us deal with the most urgent strategic issue in the Middle East, which right now is Iran's nuclear threat.
Right. I did a commentary.
We're drawing down our forces and we're retreating from the world, and that is sending the exact wrong message at the exact wrong time.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I was just saying that I've just done a commentary that talks about how we often are told Elvis left the building. Turkey has left the building of NATO, it seems to me, in everything except the formal sense, and we need to address that. But, Joel, just to drill down on this for a moment, at the time you're doing this analysis and you're looking at some of the eerie, if not downright chilling, parallels between biblical prophecy and what is developing, in addition to this Iranian threat to Israel and, yes, I would argue, to us as well, we're witnessing in this region, again, that you're very familiar with, the rise of the Muslim Brotherhood and, the so-called Salafists. How does that figure into the challenges that we're facing strategically at this moment of potential implosion?
Well, I go back to summarizing it with the phrase blood in the water. Just as sharks begin to sense when there's a reason to mass at a certain spot in the ocean because there's food, so too the radical Islamists are, whether they're Sunni or Shia, they're coming together, they're converging, despite their ethnic differences between Arabs and Persians, for example, and between their theological differences, which are huge between Sunnis and Shias, they're converging over the sense that the West is able to be toppled and that America is the kingpin in that. They see that just as the Iranian Revolution against the moderate Shah regime in 79 electrified the radicals, so too the toppling of Hosni Mubarak in Egypt, an ally of ours, admittedly an imperfect guide in the extreme, but he was still our ally.
And he's looking pretty good now.
Well, he had comparison. And so now you've got the Muslim Brotherhood in charge of Egypt. This will be electrifying to the Sunni radicals. And the combination, even in a world without Osama bin Laden, is very dangerous because you have two states now on either side of Israel and either side of the ideological and theological divide in the Middle East, Sunni, Shia, Arab, Persian, converging in their goal of creating a caliphate, an Islamic empire.
It's an identicality of mission, right? It's they're of one mind that is what they're about. They may have differences about tactics, but they're all about accomplishing the triumph of what they call Sharia and the rule of a caliph.
Absolutely. And they see America weak. They see us retreating. And so if you add to that nuclear weapons in Iran, you would have a game-changing and very dark moment.
Listen, Joel, quickly, we've only got 2 minutes left. I want to take advantage. You're not only, and our guest again is Joel Rosenberg, author most recently of Implosion, Can America Recover from Its Economic and Spiritual Challenges in Time? You've worked in the past as a expert in communications for a number of people, including Benjamin Netanyahu. He has now brought about, remarkably, a unity government that seems to give him considerable freedom of action. What, if anything, can you tell us? And I know you're not going to reveal any confidences, but what should we think about what Bibi is now thinking about in the face of these sorts of, existential threats to his own country?
Yeah. My analysis of the prime minister at this point is that Netanyahu is ready to go to war. He has his military plan in place. He has now his political team in place, which has drawn in his most vociferous rivals are now on his team in the cabinet, including Shaul Mofaz, who was born in Iran, who speaks Farsi and understands that country, and Ehud Barak, of course. I think he's ready to go to war. And I think the question for him, the timeline, and many Americans get this wrong, it's not when Iran gets the bomb. It's when Iran gets their nuclear materials and program so deep into these new tunnels and underground labs that Israel's forces couldn't neutralize those sites. Yeah. And that is rapidly approaching.
The time
I don't
is
think
at
it's
hand.
Past the end of the year.
Yeah. Oh, I don't
know. The language of Netanyahu and his advisors.
Coming. We have to let it go at that, I'm sorry to say, but I trust that we will have an opportunity as the dust settles and your successes build on the new book for further stock taking with you on all of this. Thank you for spending this time with us, Joel Rosenberg. Congratulations again on Implosion and all of the other body of work that you've produced. We appreciate you spending a little time with us and hope you will do so again very soon. Check out also, folks, the Joshua Fund, a nonprofit educational and charitable organization Joel founded and runs. Joel, thanks again. Be with
you. Thank you, Frank.
Be well and come back to us again soon. Next up, we'll be speaking with Henry Now about some of these same challenges that we're facing around the world. Straight ahead.
Hey, parents. Finding it hard to communicate with kids in today's world of ever-changing slang?
Hi, son.
Excuse me?
Introducing the Communicizer. Just strap non-toxic Communicizer to your mouth and go from boring old man speak.
Oh, you know, I'm here if you want to talk.
To 100% off the chain.
Text me whenever, yo.
It's that easy.
Thanks to Communicizer, I'm relevant to my kids again. I mean, I'll fly, boo.
And now when you buy Communicizer, you get the auto-tune attachment free. Sounds so hip-hop, your kids will want to talk to you for hours.
I used to have to walk 3 miles uphill to school every morning, shorty.
I love you, Dad.
I love you too, son.
Communicizer is not available in stores because it doesn't exist. But that's okay. You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. Because kids in foster care don't need perfection. They need you.
For more information on how you can adopt, go to AdoptUsKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt Us Kids, and the Ad Council.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. One of our time's most serious and least reported strategic developments involves a country that has for decades been considered a valued U.S. ally, Turkey. Today, Turkey's Islamist regime has so transformed that Muslim country that it can no longer accurately be described as a reliable partner. In fact, according to Dr. Barry Rubin, a top expert on the Muslim Brotherhood, after a decade of steady, patient erosion of the Turks' secular constitutional republic, quote, Turkey has now passed over towards being an Islamist state, unquote. The loss of Turkey to our enemies has been obscured by President Obama's unstinting support for its leader, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, and its continued membership in NATO. We can no longer afford, however, to ignore the fact that, like the fabled Elvis, Turkey has left the building. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedomradio.com.
Hi, I'm Drew Brees, NFL quarterback for the New Orleans Saints, here with Bugs Bunny to remind you to get moving every day.
Because when you get moving an hour a day,
you fuel your body and your mind.
So what do you like to throw around the football like Drew?
Skateboard.
Play frisbee in the park.
Ride a bike.
Kick the soccer ball around.
Or dance in your room.
Just move it your way.
Because nothing makes you feel better than moving every day.
And that makes you part of a winning team.
So be a player.
You'll have more energy to do the things you like to do.
Move it your way and be a player.
Get up and play an hour a day, Doc. Check out how to be a player at letsmove.gov.
Head online to get tips on great ways to get moving every day.
That's right, at letsmove.gov. Let's hear that one more time, Doc. That's www.letsmove.gov. A message from the Ad Council and HHS.
Okay, I got it.
It's easy to take a day for granted. You and your family are connected by routine, and you stick to it. But what if a disaster strikes without warning? What if life as you know it has completely turned on its head? What if your day's routine is disrupted, and you can't reach your family? Have you planned for that? Before a disaster turns your family's world upside down, it's up to you to be ready. Get a kit, make a plan, be informed today. Learn how at www.ready.gov. Ready.gov. This message brought to you by the Federal Emergency Management Agency and the Ad Council.
You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're joined by Henry Now. He is one of those rarities, in my estimation, in academia today, a professor of political science and international affairs at a highly regarded institution of higher learning, in this case, the George Washington University and its Elliott School of International Affairs. But despite all that, he's actually a pretty sensible fellow. And I'm very heartened by the fact that he's in the business of shaping young minds, particularly Henry Now, because we were talking earlier in the program with Joel Rosenberg about the contribution that education, as it's been practiced primarily by the left in the past, few decades, has contributed to our present parlous state. So I'm very glad to have you with us and anticipating with considerable enthusiasm a book that I know you have in the works right now on conservative internationalism. You are also, of course, the author of the highly regarded Perspectives on International Relations, Power, Institutions, and Ideas, which is in its third edition. You are in addition to a professor at the Elliott School with the, again, highly esteemed Hoover Institution out in California, where I gather we catch you now. Thank you for joining us. And tell us a little bit about sort of the thesis of this book about conservative internationalism. I know it's not available just yet, but there's a lot of turmoil in the conservative movement at the moment. Is there such a thing as internationalist mindedness still left there?
Well, I think so. You know, traditionally, of course, if you're internationalist, you've generally been thought of as a liberal. And then if you're a realist or a nationalist, you've been thought of as a conservative. But, you know, times have changed since the end of the 19th century. And people like Ronald Reagan were clearly interested in freedom, clearly interested in spreading freedom, clearly interested in improving the nature of the international system. They weren't realists in the sense that they were happy with stability and with the status quo. So that's one important characteristic of conservative internationalism, that is, conservatives do care about freedom. And the second most important part is that they know it's going to be a tough slog in order to push forward the frontiers of freedom. They know it's going to take a diplomacy armed by force, because you're dealing with non-democracies, you're dealing with unfree countries, and they use force daily in their own domestic situation and are much more ready to use force internationally. So the book is an attempt to think through sensibly the use of force as a element of diplomacy through all stages of diplomacy, telling you when it's time to engage in diplomacy, giving you some things to trade off in diplomacy, enabling you to prevent your adversary from gaining his objectives outside diplomacy. And then ultimately, which is, of course, the only role that liberal internationalists see for the use of force, being there in case the negotiations fail.
Yeah. A fascinating corpus of ideas there. Let me ask you about one thing. You started off with your sort of characterization of the sort of paradigm, I guess for want of a better word, of internationalism being an attribute of the left and realism being an attribute of the right. I know over the years that I've been involved in this business, we're often told that the realists actually are the, well, in some cases the left or at least the establishment folks on the right, and that the people who are not realists are those knuckle-dragging conservatives and ideologues, well, like Ronald Reagan. And I've always been struck that really this is this seems to me to be standing the basic common sense meaning of the word realism on its head, that people who think of the world in much the way you've just described it are realists at the core.
I think there's a lot of overlap, and that's one thing it's important for, I think, conservatives to realize. Look, realists have you know, a lot to contribute. They do understand the use of force and the balance of power and the need to push back and to establish equilibria in order to maintain peace and stability. And by the way, they want to do that in order to preserve freedom in America. Now they're more skeptical about spreading that freedom. That's where I think a new generation of conservatives have come along, represented by Ronald Reagan, and who have said, look, we can actually make the world better. We have made the world better. The world today is much better than it was 100 years ago. And particularly in the last 75 years, the number of countries that are free has grown dramatically. That contributes to a much more peaceful and healthy world, and one much more compatible with our interests than if we just settle for always maintaining the status quo. So it's not that I think the realists are part of the coalition, and we need to listen to them. And I even point out that we need to start with threats, which realism focuses us on, that it's who are our major threats. But then we need to go beyond that and say, look, in confronting those threats, how can we help to push back the frontiers of freedom? That's what Ronald Reagan did. He said, the threat from the Soviet Union and Central Europe, we're going to confront that threat, but at the same time, we're going to look for ways to promote political and economic liberalization in the Soviet Empire and ultimately in the Soviet Union itself.
Right. We're speaking with Professor Henry Now of the George Washington University and the Hoover Institution. And as it happens, Henry, I was speaking earlier in the program with, as I mentioned, I think Joel Rosenberg, about this very point, Ronald Reagan talking about freedom facing extinction in every generation and realizing that, you know, it has to be protected and, as you say, you know, expanded in the world if it is to be preserved for the next generations. To the extent that there's a fault line or fracturing on the right at the moment, Henry, it seems as though part of that is a function of disagreements about whether democracy will solve all of these natty problems, or whether, you know, it may take force, or it may take, at the very least, you know, our willingness to stand up against tyrants who are perfectly capable, in the case most immediately of the Muslim Brotherhood, of using elections to you know, essentially hijack democracy. How do you see that particular fault line, as I say, featuring in this question of internationalism at the moment?
Well, I think here again we can start with, you see, I think conservative internationalism starts with that realist focus on threats. So we focus on the threat that is posed by Iran, or the threat that is posed by Syria, or the threat that would be posed by a Muslim Brotherhood government in Egypt. And you first determine what you need to do in order to deal with that threat. And then it seems to me, then you want to look for opportunities to promote democracy. But look, in a part of the world like the Middle East, or indeed also Southwest Asia, the chances of making rapid progress towards democracy are very slim. These are parts of the world that have very little experience with it. They have no models of countries that have become democratic within their region, within their culture. So it's going to be a very long slog. So I think we need to be very realistic about what we can achieve, and therefore keep our guard up about the prospects of, you know, a democratic system emerging and good guys gaining office.
Henry, we've only got a minute left. Let me just very quickly ask you about another term that's often used in this context. And this may sound like a bit of an airy-fairy conversation, folks, but it has real-world implications. One of the other groups that we have sometimes described to us as realists are also known as pragmatists. Where do they fit into this scheme?
Yeah, no, well, I think pragmatists now, in some sense, look, if you're talking just tactically, you know, pragmatism means you're just sensible. You know, you try to be practical about how you proceed. But look, if you're talking strategically, a pragmatist is someone who just simply reacts to problems, which means that a pragmatist has no strategy. That is, the strategy is simply to solve other people's problems. Let other people raise problems, then we as pragmatists just deal with them. In other words, we look for problems. Now, somebody obviously created those problems. And as pragmatists, we just help solve them. Well, we should be more than pragmatists. We should be worried about who's creating the problems, who's setting the agenda.
And having a strategy, as you say, for dealing with them. Henry, we have to let you go at that, but this is a subject that I want to explore much more with you in the near future. I hope you'll come back again soon. Professor Henry Now of George Washington University, author most recently of Perspectives on International Relations, Power, Institutions, and Ideas. Keep up the good work, sir, and we'll talk with you very soon. Next up, Andy McCarthy joins us to talk a bit about one of these issues or areas in which we're seeing these fault lines, Syria. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
I went from a size 18 down to a size 5, and I was able to keep it off.
Angie had some serious challenges.
I had gone through a divorce and put on quite a bit of weight. There was an accident where I was put on a lot of medications, and I put on over 60 pounds. I tried every kind of diet, but diets just did not work.
Diets don't work is something they hear a lot over at the MetaSystem from Judy Singer.
I heard about Judy Singer's MetaSystem, and I thought, well, you know, couldn't hurt to call, and I called them up, and they told me all about the product, and I thought, well, I'll give it a try. From the first week that I was on it, I wasn't hungry a lot, and it was just amazing. Jumping about 3 months ahead, I dropped 63 pounds.
If you're ready for a natural product that cleanses your system and helps you lose fat, talk to a Judy Singer counselor about the MetaSystem. Call 1-800-711-JUDY, 1-800-711-JUDY. The MetaSystem from Judy Singer. Powerful, all-natural weight loss. 1-800-711-JUDY.
Hi. This is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though.
Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its special forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home was built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
Is Nancy Pelosi looking to a higher power to get a balanced budget? Hugh Hewitt sets her straight.
When I hear you speak about this issue, of course, it's the Gospel of Matthew. When I was hungry, you gave me to eat and listen.
I just got to stop here. Nancy Pelosi quoting the Gospel of Matthew, as though that's got anything to do with the government. Let me just tell you, it doesn't.
Can I get an amen?
The Hugh Hewitt Show, weeknights from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone.
At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there.
So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need, and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill,
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home, or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org.
Even if it's just everyday stuff,
like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Really?
What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're joined once again, as we have the privilege of being each week, by our friend, colleague, and much admired leader, Andy McCarthy. He's the leader specifically of the Islamophobic wing. Andy, I remember hearing that credit being given to you, and I don't think of you as an Islamophobe at all, but I certainly think of you as a leader.
I have to say, Frank, as one of my loyal subjects,
lieutenants,
as you're supposed to be, I would have expected you to remember my title. It really hurts me.
Yes, well, I apologize for getting this wrong, but I'll just call you your Nibs. How's that? Anyway, your Nibs, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Thank you, sir.
Wonderful to be here.
Let's talk about something we visited about a little bit last week. You had unburdened yourself, as I recall, over Memorial Day weekend on the Republican presidential nominee endorsing an idea from one of his senior advisors, John McCain, of arming the Syrian opposition. Since you warned against that idea, there have been several developments that would seem to only reinforce your admonition. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, well, it does seem, Frank, that there are very powerful indications reported first by John Rosenthal in National Review Online that it was, in fact, rebel, or what's being called rebel factions that were
AKA the opposition.
No. Yeah, what you and I think would think of as the Syrian Mujahideen, not to be confused with the Libyan Mujahideen, the last set of lovable rebels that we...
Or Webbles, as you called them.
Yes, Waskily Webbles.
Waskily Webbles.
Yeah, but it looks like the jihadists or the Islamic supremacists are the ones who are behind the massacre in Hullalah that many have pointed to as a rationale for actually intervening against Assad. Now, I don't carry any brief for Assad. In fact, I think the non-interventionist position has been misrepresented by a lot of critics. We're not championing Assad. We're simply saying that there is a lightning rod effect that the United States has on our fractious enemies in the world who despise each other but abhor us more and therefore are drawn together when we intervene, even when it's not in our interest to intervene. And our position is not that you need to champion Assad or champion al-Qaeda and the Muslim Brotherhood, which is the other side of this conflict, but simply if we stay out of it and they beat each other's brains in, that's good for the United States.
Yeah. I guess the principal argument, of course, is that it may be pretty hard on the innocent Syrian population that find themselves between the al-Qaeda's and the Muslim Brothers and the Assad thugs.
Yeah, and look, I am not without human sympathy for that. I would only point out that there are innocent civilians being persecuted and slaughtered all over the world every day. Many of them religious minorities who are being abused in Islamic countries, and these people don't make a peep about that.
Yeah. Well, and let's talk about some of those people in Syria itself, as it happens, at the moment being told by the commanding officer of this Syrian opposition force to get the hell out. What's up with that, and who are those people?
Well, it looks like we're talking about a Christian enclave in particular, where 9/10 of the population has already vacated. And what we're seeing replicated, frankly, is what we saw in and continue to see in Iraq, which is that, once the Islamist elements take over governments, they institute their rigorous program of dhimmitude, whether they do it officially or unofficially. But the bottom line, whether it's in Egypt or Iraq or now in Syria, is that religious minorities and Christians in particular get persecuted and get driven out. I would say that Jews also, except Jews have already gone through that.
They've already bailed, yeah. Andy McCarthy is our guest. He is, of course, the essayist par excellence at National Review Online, a former federal prosecutor, author of Willful Blindness and The Grand Jihad, among other books. And Andy, I guess I just want to pause here for a moment on this dhimmitude bit, because I think – to the extent anybody knows what that term means, they probably think of it as, well, second-class citizenship status or maybe enslavement more accurately. But it also has this natty quality to it, doesn't it, that you really survive at the sufferance of the Muslim overlords. You pay a jizya tax. But if they decide that your life is forfeit, as they say, you're dead.
Yeah, well, that's right, Frank. And actually, as I understand it, the term is derived both from the Islamic term for a contract or an agreement, coupled with this connotation of exactly what you're talking about, second class citizenship. And the idea comes directly from the Quran, which in Surah 9 not only says that. Basically that non-Muslims will be persecuted unless they pay the jizya, but that they should feel themselves subjugated in the process of paying it. So the idea is not only to fund the Islamic State, which is of no small importance, but you often hear this canard about how the Quran says there shall be no compulsion in religion. Well, yeah, they won't force you to convert at the point of a gun, but they will make things as unattractive as possible, and that's putting it mildly, to be a non-Muslim by the imposition of Sharia law. So no, they won't convert you at the point of a gun, at least not officially, but they will impose this rigorous, really abusive Sharia system, which is the goal of which is to get everybody of a mind that it sure is better to be a Muslim than to be a non-Muslim trying to live through this.
Yeah. Andy, I've got two other things that I want to cover with you quickly. I would just say my guess is, I have to check this with one of our Sharia scholars, but my guess is that that no compulsion business was abrogated by the other verses that make it quite clear that you are to put everyone to the sword if they fail to conform. But Andy, quickly, one of the other things that's troubled me, especially after you wrote the piece about Mitt Romney endorsing arming of what amounts to Al-Qaeda and the Brotherhood, he seemed to decide that the proper place in America to launch his views on or expose people to his views on education reform was an Islamist school, a charter school in Philadelphia. What's up with that?
Yeah, well, I wish I knew what was up with that. I think it's a very troubling sign that that Governor Romney, of all the places that he could have appeared, chose that particular place to make an appearance. Kenny Gamble, who is the one who runs that school and whose Muslim name escapes me at the moment, is. He's an interesting character, and he's got even more interesting friends, or at least associates, people like Siraj Wahaj, who is pretty notorious for Islamist inflammatory rhetoric. I just think it's a terrible sign that that's where Governor Romney decided to do his outreach.
I hope this will be a subject for a future column by you, Andy McCarthy, exploring how it is he got there and what we might take away from it. If this is evidence of another sort of Muslim outreach by a Republican candidate, I fear it augurs ill for the future, to say the least. If you'd like to know more about that, folks, check out MuslimBrotherhoodInAmerica.com. It shows what happened the last time a Republican presidential candidate went down that road, George W. Bush. Andy, quickly, there's a hearing on Thursday of this week in which we will be once again importuned to have the Senate ratify the Law of the Sea Treaty. Very quickly. International law as a bulwark for our national security?
Yeah, disastrous idea. International law, as I've said any number of times, Frank, is really a game. And it's a game that the United States always manages to lose, or at least the part of the United States that still believes in us as a sovereign, self-determining people. I mean, the idea is basically you put your fate in the hands of a bunch of international law professors who, by a little hocus-pocus that's known as customary international law, changes the ground beneath your feet with some regularity and never to our benefit.
Right, or the water in this case surrounding our shores. Andy McCarthy, as always, elegantly said and absolutely on point. We'll look forward to your commentary after the hearing this week and featuring, among others, happily, two opposition witnesses, one Donald Rumsfeld and Stephen Groves, a frequent guest here at Secure Freedom Radio. So stay tuned for that, folks. We'll be covering it extensively. Andy McCarthy, thanks to you for joining us this week. We look forward to talking with you next and to talking with the rest of you tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.